Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9. Bent Notes is our weekly jazz program going to air each Sunday night.
My special guest tonight on Bent Notes is Melbourne-based pianist, composer, arranger, musical director, radio broadcaster and educator. I think I'll just stop the list at that point in time, Adam Rudigear. Adam is described as having an interest in exploring the synthesis of jazz, funk and more experimental music styles and is about to release his second album in the Bowie Project. I wonder if that's a Bowie Project series. Adam, welcome to Bent Notes.
Thank you very much, David.
It's been a while since we've had you in studio.
Yes, it's not like I've stopped releasing things. I'd like to give you a bit of a rest, I suppose.
Well, you got to share yourself around, don't you?
Try. I do my best. I'm spread thin, I'll be honest.
An interest in the synthesis of jazz, funk and more experimental styles. What does that mean?
Well, it's probably a play on words, really, because I like synthesizers, so synthesis there. But synthesis, of course, means like combining things. I don't like to stay in the one spot and do the same thing too much, so I can't really choose sides, you know what I mean? So I love jazz, I love funk, I love everything in between, and I just sort of like flit around those two areas and try and like push the boundaries of taste and common decency as often as possible.
Well, that's probably not a bad way to go, to keep yourself amused and interested.
It keeps me amused and interested, but depending on how conservative the listener is, that may it may rub them the wrong way, but well, it is what it is.
Let's take it back. Where did your musical appreciation start?
Did my mum call you up and ask me to tell you to ask me that?
No.
Well, I would have to credit my mother, Remy, for that. My dad is not a huge music fan. I think his music tastes go, it's a very narrow spectrum. It goes for like ABBA on one side. Do you remember the band Bread?
I do, actually.
Yeah, Bread would be on the other side. Oh. So that's sort of like the scope of it.
Interesting combination.
With my dad, my mother, on the other hand, she loves a lot of different music, but I mainly remember listening to a lot of jazz growing up. She doesn't play herself, but she's the reason that I heard, you know, Vince Jones and Kate Sobrano's jazz, early jazz records, and a lot of other stuff too. And she, you know, we share a mutual appreciation of Oscar Peterson and Thelonious Monk, and I guess she got me into piano players as well. So,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, that's where it came from initially.
So jazz was there fairly early on then?
Yeah, I feel like even if I didn't understand really the mechanics of it, I understood the language and I knew lots of standards. I had a big repertoire, like I could hum you the tunes, and I knew the lyrics even, you know, before, way before I started to learn actually how to play that stuff. And we can both pick out things by ear, so I guess that talent came from mum as well. She's never really pursued it, but I pursued it a lot. So.
What a great skill to be able to do. When did you start physically playing an instrument? Was it the piano or was it something else?
It was piano. I had a piano in the house from a very early age. I just started off picking out things by ear that I liked, and I taught myself to play the James Bond theme, and I pretty much stuck with that.
We played that tonight.
Yeah, wow. Yes. Cool. Well, I pretty much stuck with that. For Prince, it was Batman. He learned to play Batman, which is cool because he ended up, of course, scoring the Batman, doing the song soundtrack to the 1989 Tim Burton film. I liked James Bond, and I pretty much stuck with that throughout my entire childhood. That's pretty much the only thing that I knew how to play. Then in my teenage years, I always listened to film music, and I love film music, and then I got right into Prince and the Minneapolis sound and funk and things like that, and also Harry Connick Jr. And at the time, Harry Connick was delving into more funky areas. He did those two great albums, She and Star Turtle, and I was right with him all the way, and Mum was saying, oh, I think he's gone a bit off the rails, so I just want him to stick to doing jazz standards. I was like, no, this is so good, and I was just starting to get into Herbie Hancock and that sort of thing, so the more funky stuff. But I also love all Harry's jazz stuff as well. And I was listening to those New Orleans piano players, and they've been a huge influence on me. So Harry and Dr. John and James Booker and John Cleary and all those sorts of guys.
When did you decide that, apart from just the fact that you enjoyed all this and you could pick it out on the piano, that it was actually going to be something that you would use as a career?
I guess it was a desire, but nobody really told me that was a thing that you could do. So I arguably wasted a lot of time doing things like studying film. I don't think that was a waste of time, actually. But I went to a rehearsal in high school. They had a blues band, and you could go along to the rehearsals at lunchtime and just watch them rehearse. I was just blown away because they played all music I loved, like Blues Brothers and also, you know, Muddy Waters and things I didn't necessarily know, but I loved blues music. I didn't know much about it, but I loved the sound. And that I got right into that before I figured out how to play jazz. So I realized I didn't have a keyboard player. And I thought, wow, I could be the keyboard player. And I went up, talked to the teacher, and I said, do you need a keyboard player? He said, yeah. He goes, you know, blues, it's just all like seventh chords. I was like, yeah, no worries. And I went home and I went, what the hell is a seventh chord? And I opened up the piano stool and I found a book in there of music theory. You know, there was always a bunch of random stuff in the piano stool, wasn't there?
Of course, that's where all good music sits.
And it told you the three main types of seventh chord, the major seven, the minor seven, the dominant seven. And I had no idea which one he meant. And I went to, this is such a, it's not a stupid question when you don't know anything and you're a beginner, but I went up to him the next day and I said, so does, which type of seventh chord does blues use? And now, of course, I know the answer, and that it never possibly be any other answer but the dominant seventh chord. I had no idea at the time, and I was like, oh my God, I have to play four notes at once. And I would just play that, the same chord in both hands, the same voicing. You know, I was like a real beginner too. And I think he realized he'd made a mistake letting me in the band, because as soon as he heard me play, he was like, this kid doesn't know anything. I loved the music and I knew and I could hum it, I could sing it to you, but I didn't really know how to play it on piano. So just for the next few years, I just spent ages and ages trying to nut it out on my own. And I got a teacher to teach me that stuff outside of school. And it went okay, but it wasn't till years later when I met Steve Settergreen that he really demystified how to play jazz and where blues fits in, and just really showed me the links between a whole lot of things and really helped me understand the language.
It was the light bulb moment.
Absolutely. And that just invigorated my passion for it even more. Like, I was really hungry to learn about this stuff. But once you then realize that it's actually a possibility that you could do it for a career, like for a living, and you start to see how that could be possible, then that was just like a whole retro rocket to my enthusiasm. So I've been trying to make that a thing. I had studied film and I sort of ditched that, and I'd been studying in Queensland. I moved back to Melbourne so I could study with Steve, and I've been in bands and running my own bands and making albums.
So in your bands and the albums and everything else that you do, you decide on a particular focus for an album that's coming up or a particular band. How do you make your decision as to what it is you're going to do?
It's just based on my artistic impulses. You know, I'll have a very strong feeling that I should explore one, you know, a thing. And it will have a focus, but it will often have a concept behind it. So, for example, with Lake Minnetonka, it's very influenced by Prince and his music, but it's not a Prince cover band. It's original music that is based in the Minneapolis sound, but I'm really trying to open it up to collaborations and take it to a new place. With the Bowie project, the idea behind it is not to have a vocalist and to remove David Bowie himself from the equation so that there's nothing left but the composition, and use that as a vehicle for improvisation. Because I think that in, you know, David Bowie is such a powerful figure in pop culture, that force of his personality and his persona and even his distinctive voice and his weird lyrics, it overshadows. Or it's not, you know, his compositions don't get enough emphasis. I think they're really underrated. People love his songs, but that's because they love David Bowie. And just hearing David Bowie makes people happy. And I didn't get that for a really long time. And it was the first thing that caught my ear and made me want to explore him more was that I was like, that song doesn't make any sense. The lyrics don't make sense. The chords don't make sense. I can't tell if he's a genius or he has no idea what he's doing. That was really interesting, and that made me want to explore it more. And we have a great time trying to improvise on these themes, and he writes such great thematic motifs, and they're not the regular thing that you would think of, you know. He's so special in that way.
A little bit out of left field.
Yeah, but that's what makes him great.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Find more Joycasts and show blogs, go to joy.org.au.
Adam, you've just been talking about moving into the David Bowie project, which you're now heading into the second phase of that project with David Bowie Project 2, It's Always Time. I'm intrigued with the title, It's Always Time.
Yeah, so it comes from a lyric from this song, New Angels of Promise, which I doubt anybody who is not a diehard Bowie fan would know. It's from the album Hours, which I think is from the year 1999. I love it. I think that song is amazing. And there's just so many Bowie albums, and people tend to stop listening after a certain point. You may be a fan of 70s Bowie or 80s Bowie. Maybe you're my age and you remember Labyrinth, or maybe you're older and you were with him all through the 70s. But people tend to drop off. And of course, everybody can come together and go, yes, Black Star was a masterpiece, but what about this wilderness of the 90s and the noughties? And so it's one of those albums. And It's Always Time just seems to resonate with me. It pertains strongly to jazz. You know, it's always time. When you're playing jazz, you're living in the moment. You're responding to what's going on. It's like, it's always time to play jazz. It's always a good time for music to be a positive, powerful force in your life. So the more I thought about it, the more I was like, this is the perfect title. And I didn't want to go, I can't stand like tribute projects that are like Ziggy Stardust, the David Bowie tribute. I cannot go there. So I needed to do something obscure and a bit hip. So,
I like the title.
Thank you.
It does make sense. Did the project proceed as you thought it would before you stepped out into the project world?
No, I guess I was involved in an epic battle with a few friends, because I'm, as anybody that knows me is well aware, I'm a massive Prince junkie.
And now, before you go any further, we had a question popped in around about 7:30 tonight. It's from South Yarra, and it's a question for yourself, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
It says, and while you're thinking on Prince here,
okay,
could you kindly ask your guest, which is yourself, who is a huge Prince fan, can we expect to see a jazz symphony or tribute of Mr. Nelson's songs here in Australia?
I'm probably not going to do one, because everybody expects that of me. So I like to be a bit unpredictable. I know that Questlove is actually directing a symphonic Prince tribute right now that was just performed, I think, in the last week or so. So that may tour. But also St. Paul Peterson musically directed the Nothing Compares to Prince show that was at Hamer Hall a few months ago, which was, it wasn't symphonic, it was a bunch of Prince band members. That was an amazing show. But yeah, I hope the Questlove one comes out here. That'll be good. So it's out there. And the New Power Generation, of course, performed at First Avenue just the other night, and they did a live stream thing that you could watch.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was up for 2 days. So I've been working my way through that today, because it's 3 hours long and it was pretty great.
That's a big chunk of time to put aside.
Yeah, I was trying to fit it in.
South Yarra has put another comment in, Adam. A fantastic interview. It's why music and art is so important in school education, as well as traditional subjects, to influence people like Adam. You were talking earlier on in the interview about being influenced by so many people and being able to expand upon that at school.
Yeah, it was while I was at school, but it wasn't in my classes. I didn't take music class beyond year eight, or when you had to do it, you know. And I went to St. Michael's, and it had a great music department, but it was very classically oriented. And the blues band was really the only thing at the time that was outside of that. I really liked that. Now things are different, and it's I think there's some great jazz musicians coming out of St. Michael's, but back in my day, it wasn't quite the same.
Not quite the same.
Back
to the Bowie project, is why you're specifically here. You kicked off with the original album back in 2015. What was the response like to that initial phase of the project?
Well, I was a little apprehensive, because I thought I might piss off the jazz police by doing a, you know, basically a pop kind of jazz project. And then I thought I might piss off the Bowie fans, because they're like, this isn't David Bowie. But quite the opposite happened. And there's been a great response. First of all, we got invited to perform at Acme at the Bowie Is exhibition. I played some solo piano on the opening night. And then the Bowie Project as a band came and played. We launched our first album at Stonington Jazz Festival, which was just called the Bowie Project. And Bowie Down Under, which is the Australia New Zealand fan club, have been hugely supportive. And I want to give a shout out to Adam Dean, who's one of the higher ranking members of that organization. And he's just been great. And we've become really good friends, and we hang out and have lunch now. So the Bowie fans have come out and always found, I think they really appreciate that I don't just play the hits. And it's very important for me to delve deep. And I do some hits, you know, I'm not trying to be esoteric deliberately, but what I look for in Bowie is not tied down by any nostalgia of his career. Oh, wow, I love Ziggy Stardust, and that's my only conception of it. You know, I'm trying to sort of give a broader view of his career. So we do things from Space Oddity all the way up to stuff that was recorded around the Black Star sessions but wasn't even on Black Star. So I'm trying to go very deep. And apparently Tony Visconti, the famed producer of Heroes and a bunch of other, and Black Star and a bunch of other Bowie things, heard a bit of our new album the other day, thanks to Dr. Leah Cardos, who works with him at Kingston University in London.
Oh, superb.
And Bowie's pianist Mike Garson was kind enough to write us some liner notes, so he had a listen too, and he had some really nice things to say,
which
you can read about when you pick up the physical copy at our launch at the Paris Cat on Saturday.
Next Saturday night, isn't it?
Saturday the 22nd.
9:30 kickoff.
Yeah, we like to go late.
Upstairs or downstairs?
I don't know. Downstairs. I would say the late show is usually downstairs.
In the little basement area. Yeah. Beautiful, intimate area to perform in.
I love every part of the Paris Cat. I've played there so many times in my life.
And yes, I have seen your name on the program there many times.
It never gets old. That it's such a great place to play.
Who's in the band?
Well, the Bowie Project is kind of like an evolving lineup. So on the album, we have Tom Sly on trumpet. We used an expanded horn section, so usually we have two horn players. We have three on this new record. So we have Niels Rosendahl on Barry Sax, and he plays some flute as well. Tom Sly on trumpet, and Phil Hayter on alto sax. And then we've got the tried and true rhythm section, my favourite rhythm section, of Tom Mitchell on the drums and Adam Spiegel on the bass, and I play piano.
A great band.
Thank you. I like them.
Will there be a Bowie Project 3, do you reckon?
Absolutely.
There's plenty of material to use, isn't there?
There's no shortage of material. Conceptually, in the next album, I plan on going a bit electric, and we're going to explore some 70s Herbie Hancock type vibes. So we've done the Electric Bowie Project twice as a live gig and a workshop, some arrangements of Fame and Fashion and some other cool stuff, and they stretch right out and go quite psychedelic. But I haven't done this yet, but I also have another idea to arrange things like New Orleans brass band, like funk.
Oh, wow.
A bit like Horns of Leroy or the Rebirth brass band. Yeah. Or Dirty Dozen or that kind of thing. And I've got a few ideas. I think that All You Pretty Things could work very well, and The Man Who Sold the World. So I'm going to figure out some arrangements and get that happening, I think.
Oh, you're going to be busy.
I'm always busy.
You are indeed. What do we need to listen to when we're listening to the Bowie Project 2?
In terms of what elements of the music?
Yeah, what's inside it?
Well, I don't want to make the music really esoteric. Like, it's jazz improvisation, but really Bowie is, even he himself said he was a pop artist. So pop music is based on hooks and melodies, and that's really, really important. That's what makes the tune recognisable. So if you know the song, you're not, you know, it's not going to be reinvented beyond all recognition. But there's probably a few, unless you're a diehard Bowie fan, there's probably a few obscurities in there that you don't know. So just listen to those melodies, and they're there, and you'd be like, wow, what is this? That melody's beautiful. How have I never heard that? And you might go and check out that Bowie album from 1999 or, the late 80s or the ones that people are afraid of. Oh, man, Bowie was crap in the 80s or whatever. But there's much like Prince, Bowie was incredibly prolific, and there are gems on every single album. Even the albums that people think are duds, there's one or two in there that are just like fantastic. He always had something really great to bring to the table.
You're providing people the opportunity to go and rediscover David Bowie.
Totally. Well, you know, for some, Bowie never left, and some people can jump right back in where they maybe weren't ready to take it on.
And actually, that's a good point, because often you'll hear something and you're not ready to hear what you're hearing because you haven't heard enough to understand it.
Well, these artists that we're talking about are ahead of their time. So often the world isn't ready for them, and it can take a long time for the world to get ready. I think there's a lot to be said for revisiting stuff. And when I came to Bowie, you know, I was really late to Bowie. I didn't grow up worshipping him or anything. So I just had to do all this research and do a bunch of like really active listening and just curious listening and keep an open mind. So I wasn't trying to judge it like, is this good music, is this bad music, but I was trying to think, okay, when I listen to this tune, can I turn this into jazz, a vehicle for improvisation? If it's one chord all the way through, then, you know, maybe it's not going to be that interesting, but if I hear an interesting progression, I'm like, oh, I could do something with that. Is that going to lend itself to being a bossa or a free jazz freakout or a fast swing or like a dollar brand Abdul Ibrahim kind of South African thing. Like I'm always thinking, what kind of groove would meld well with this particular song? So we have an individual approach for each piece. It's not just like, oh, we can do Bowie jazz, swing it, baby. You know, it's not like that at all.
It's much more complex and much more individualized.
Yeah, it's complex for us, our job is to make it easy for you to listen to. And I don't mean easy listening. I don't mean smooth jazz, but I mean accessible. You listen to it and you're intrigued and you go, this is cool. Yeah. I don't know what it is. I don't necessarily understand it, but
I certainly loved listening to the album this week that you gave me a preview of it, and it's just superb.
Thank you. What are some of your favourites? I'm curious.
Well, I reckon the one that I enjoyed the most, I think it was Loving the Alien, and Space Oddity I quite enjoyed. But I think Space Oddity because that's a melody that I actually recognise. I'm not a great David Bowie fan myself, but that one I recognised, that sort of said something. Loving the Alien I loved.
Space Oddity and Loving the Alien, those arrangements couldn't be more opposite. Because Loving the Alien, I just called it on the night. I said, hey, let's do Loving the Alien. And I had the chart for Phil to play the sax line. We didn't discuss the arrangement. We just sort of played it. And then Space Oddity is very, very worked out. And it has all sorts of time signature changes, and we have to play it like exactly right. So they're like diametrically opposed. So I love that you gravitated to those.
Interesting that I have. Well, Adam, thank you so much for popping in. Next Saturday night is the launch of the Bowie Project 2, It's Always Time, at the Paris Cat. All the details are at pariscat.com.au.
Correct.
A great way to see the Bowie Project in action in a jazz club. In the meantime, we're going to have a listen to another piece. In fact, I think we'll have a listen to Loving the Alien. We must say just a very big thank you for popping in.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me again, David.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.